Good morning. Getting rid of invasives is one thing. Keeping them from ever arriving in Hawaii is another. A draft interagency plan would do both. Today we'll get some of the details before the public is asked to comment next month. The chief of the Ag Department's Biological Control Section will join us. And we'll check in with Neil Conan to see where his thoughts are this week. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
I'm Bill Sage. From a classically trained garage band to gaining success by completely blowing it, the new Honolulu Chamber Music Series season and glass-blowing expert Mark Matsuda.
Not just some of the conversation coming your way this hour, but first, a look at the news.
Aloha kakahiaka kako. Good morning, everybody, and good morning to you, Beth Ann.
Good morning, and welcome to The Conversation.
And on The Conversation today, conversation might be heading in a direction where, sort of like it seems to be the snuffling and sneezing season upon us once more, as it's as if many residents of Hawaii are suffering their own little invasive species.
And that happens a lot, but just as often do we see invasives come to our islands that perhaps aren't so easily dealt with, and then we're going to talk about that this morning. Now, you've no doubt heard the expression that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. It's an idea that informed the protection of Hawaii from invasive species, but now the Department of Agriculture is taking that concept to a new level. In the draft of the 2017-27 Interagency Biosecurity Plan, the prevention is extended to stopping invasives from ever reaching Hawaii with some offshore inspections. The plan is also the first time there will be coordination among partner agencies. Darcy Oishi is the Biological Control Section Chief with the Department of Ag, and he's with us this morning. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
With a message that would be so important for people to understand, and with some of the messaging that we've seen in past, it might seem logical that these agencies would have been networked already and working in partnership with each other. Why now?
Well, why now? It's because we need a blueprint for the future. And while we have been working together collaboratively up until this point, what we wanted to do was lay out a clear 10-year vision of what we need to do to adequately protect Hawaii from the threat of invasive species.
What's tops on the list?
Well, there's a lot of tops on the list.
I mean, it's a huge list is the point.
Yes. So, you know, what we want to do specifically with the biosecurity plan is essentially create something that is more proactive in terms of our ability to respond to invasive species and to keep more and more invasive species from getting onto Hawaii shores, because that's what that makes the most sense. And when they do get to Hawaii shore, we want to be able to have response plans ready and available, so we're not trying to invent the wheel while we're acting on these invasive species.
Which is sort of the place that you're in now.
Yes, I've run response programs for the department, and sometimes, you know, we're playing catch up in terms of structuring the response or identifying exactly what we need to do. A lot of times it works, but a lot of times it also gives me extra gray hairs.
And for a lot of people who have been dealing with invasives, whether there's something in their own gardens or just looking at what's happening that might threaten the state entirely, it's a weighty question to think about how it is that you prevent it. But the idea that we can't do it alone seems to be one that would be fairly logical to understand. But is that also something that is understood by partner agencies away from Hawaii, other countries, other states?
Yes, it is. It's we work, for instance, very closely with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They are solid partners in our biosecurity plan and the protection of Hawaii as it is right now. And we've been increasing within the department conversations with both California and Florida, who are, we engage in the trade of invasive species. None of us really intend it, but it always happens. And by partnering them with them, we're going to be improving our abilities to respond and hopefully prevent issues from spreading between our municipalities.
California and Florida, largely because we have so much produce coming from there?
California, because a lot of our agricultural products do come from California, but in a large portion, it's because we have similar subtropical environments that are conducive for invasive species from one region to establish in another.
Are California and Florida as concerned about what we might send to them as we are about what they might send to us?
That's kind of an understatement. They're very concerned. And, you know, for California, they're literally one of the breadbaskets of the country and the world. So anything that jeopardizes their agricultural production is something that they really do not want. And probably 9 out of the 10 invasive species that they do not want, we either have or are a pathway for.
So if they feel that way, was there any movement on their part before now to be able to engage us in the way that we are now trying to engage them with this plan?
Well, we have cooperative agreements, or California has made cooperative agreements with Hawaii in the past. So a lot of our products, cut flowers, fruits, vegetables, they do have to go through a pre-clearance program or some sort of certification check in order to ensure that we're not infecting California with our undesirables. And Florida kind of piggybacks on some of those same issues too.
This is also backing into a conversation about what it is we want to bring into Hawaii and what it is that we might need to do to change our tastes for things or to be able to change our sensibilities about things. I mean, certainly we've had instances with Christmas trees that have been infested, and yet people still want to have a live Christmas tree or certain flowers or certain things that would be seasonal someplace else, but clearly not available here.
Yeah, and Christmas trees are a good example. The department is already beginning to think about Christmas trees. So we actually beat the retail stores in pre-staging Christmas because in order for someone to have Christmas trees, we actually have to start working with the states that send Christmas trees, which are California,
Oregon
and Washington, Oregon being the primary shipper, very early on in order to make sure that it's clean. And if the market weren't there, it would save the state a lot of money in terms of what we need to do, but also the risks that the Christmas trees impose when they come in.
Some have asked, couldn't we grow our own Christmas trees? Is that possible in Hawaii? Or do we need to just either say we'll put up with what we have to deal with?
It depends on how one defines what a Christmas tree looks
so my
like,
ficus
feels
might
like,
count?
And smells like. Well, your ficus could count as long as you think it's festive enough.
Well, which is kind of back to the same point of what it is that we need to be able to have the things that we want to have without necessarily being threatening. How much are we willing to move as consumers into certain places that maybe we haven't gone before or might be willing to, given some of the issues of sustainability that we've talked about, certainly talking about the cost of bringing goods here, knowing that we're going to continue to have to bring goods into Hawaii, whether we kind of like it or not, it's a reality for right now.
Yeah, and the biosecurity plan recognizes that as much as we want to move away from importation, that we do, like all other island entities, we're going to be importing a significant amount of material, and we want to make sure that that is as safe and clean as possible so it does not pose problems once it gets here.
With everything that we've talked about and changes of messaging and better relationships working with other states, other countries, and certainly within agencies within Hawaii, is the message enough? Is it going to resound well enough, do you think, to be able to convince the ledge that this is worth the price tag of $39 million annually?
That will be settled in January when we begin the legislative session. I would hope that, coming together, multiple departments with a comprehensive ask, with a clear blueprint, will make for a compelling argument. I know it's hard to swallow a price fixed package that we're presenting, but the price fixed package usually means a better deal in the long run than a la carte.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you, Darcy.
Thank you.
Darcy Oishi is the Biological Control Section Chief with the State Department of Agriculture.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting Spyro Gyra in two shows nightly, on stage tonight through September 18th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16. Coming up next, your backyard quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawai.
Fans of the popular television series Game of Thrones and the book series on which it's based know well the city of King's Landing. But even the biggest fan might not know that a real-life King's Landing exists here in Hawaii. In fact, the two even bear some similarities. The fictional King's Landing was the place of death for several generations of monarchs, and Hawaii's first king came very close to losing his own life at a site now known as King's Landing. That king was Kamehameha I, and that story, which we'll have for you in the second half of the show, involved a canoe paddle and one hard head. But for today's quiz, we want to know the Hawaiian name for this King's Landing and its location. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Good morning, I'm Daniel, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, live on the web at hpr2.org.
When they were composing, Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Mozart, they were writing modern music. At a few centuries, we call their creations classical. And if you enjoy them, the Honolulu Chamber Music Series opens its 2016-2017 season in 2 weeks with a string trio whose members refer to themselves as a classically trained garage band. Time for three. They can and do play anything from Mozart to bluegrass to hip-hop. And chamber music president pianist Jonathan Korth joins us in studio this morning to discuss them, some of the stuff he's done, and other wonderful performers will be on stage at Oliver's Auditorium this season. Aloha, Jonathan.
Hey, thanks for having me in the studio today.
You're very welcome. So this group, the first group you're having, which is Time for Three, now, it's amazing. Everybody from Kanye West to Mozart, they can do it on their three, and yet they started out as classical musicians, but supposedly they almost have a grunge casualness about them when they perform.
Absolutely. So I think they destroy most stereotypes about classical musicians. It's even someone I would say I put myself into that same category. Mm-hmm. You've got these two fantastic classically trained violinists who now can improvise and really do arrangements. And then they paired up with this bassist, so you've got this really interesting kind of dynamic. The bassist does things on the bass. You know, we think of a bassist in a jazz trio as someone who just, you know, kind of controls the ground. Exactly. But, you know, he has all of these extended techniques to make it sound like a cello or even other string or percussion instruments. So mm-hmm. this trio suddenly morphs into something where you've just got entirely different sounds on stage. And as you heard in the Hallelujah Open here, arrangements of pieces you might know heard in completely different ways.
So some of the stuff, apparently the start, these guys, were two of them are playing for the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra. There was a power outage. And the auditorium was pitch black, just a couple of flashlights, and they figure, well, we can't lose it. So they just got up and started jamming in the dark.
Absolutely. And, you know, they have this new violinist, Charles Young, who also does the same type of thing. And I think all of them are known for their kind of impromptu style on stage, whether that's the way they play, even the way they talk to the audience. So mm-hmm. I think you'll see, no matter what happens, I mean, say we have a loss of power, I think you still have a good show from them.
It's going to go, okay, it's the all acute. It's unplugged. Well, okay, it's going to keep going. Now, when you started, the same sort of thing, the muse of music. Yeah. When you were a kid, what first grabbed your musical ear?
That's a great question. I have to say, very, very basically, at the very beginning, it was just, wow, I can make a tune out of these piano keys that are in front of me. I think I was 4 years old and uh-huh. was just really intrigued by that. By the time I was a teenager is when I really started to jump into this more seriously and one, realized how affecting music could be, I think, at that age where, you know, particularly emotional in a lot of aspects of our mm-hmm. life. And so music for me was certainly an escape in some ways. And then also I was seeing I could have success with it and mm-hmm. realized, wow, I could even do this as a career. That's something that, you know, I hadn't really thought about before. So it kind of took off from there. And to be honest, the passion and the love of music is still there today as it was many, many years ago.
So you evolved, once you started making tunes, were you schooled in the classics early on or popular music?
Yeah, so I even started in a Suzuki program, which I know a lot of kids in Hawaii do, and then I moved on to more standard classical training. But almost all of my training is classical, but I do branch out occasionally for just gigs and that type of thing.
So when you branch out on the gigs, are you sitting there thinking, if only everybody in the world is a musician, there wouldn't be any wars?
Often, yeah.
the way you said that music can become an escape,
yeah,
and yet when it brings you back, how do you think it improves your life?
I think music can take us to places that maybe normal life can't in, mm-hmm. in many ways. Specifically, the music I play, you know, we're looking at something like you talked about in the opening, something from Bach's time. We're talking over 250 years ago to even music of today, in ways that. You know, we don't necessarily understand what those composers were going through, but we can understand the emotional impact of what their music is saying, and I think that's still real and viable for today as well as it was a long time ago.
The depth of the emotion.
Absolutely.
So music gets you completely in the present, even if that present has been.
I mean, I certainly hope so, and you see throughout history people kind of pour their passions into music and then use it as an escape, even in some of the worst settings that we've had in history.
And even the modern, what Kanye West is talking about, bullying, and those guys are getting
Absolutely.
Into it with the background of it.
Yeah.
Now, some of the rest of the season coming up, we have the Dover String Quartet coming next.
Yeah, we've got a fantastic season this year. I get on the radio now. I've done this for 3 or 4 years, and I really do wax poetic about every season. But this one, I think people are going to recognize a lot of names from our season. The Dover String Quartet is a quartet that's playing over 150 concerts a year right now around the U.S., so they're extremely popular. They're again, younger, but really, really dynamic. Our next concert in January is Garrick Olson. That's mm-hmm. a name most people who are classical music fans will recognize. He was a 1970 winner of the Chopin International Competition. He's had concerto appearances here before, but to best of my knowledge, he's never done a solo recital in Honolulu, so this is a really big event in January. The Eroica Piano Trio is again a group a lot of people will recognize. They're coming in February. And then we've got a chamber group from the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra from Amsterdam coming in. Five players. It'll be a string quartet plus clarinet for a concert in March. So we are really excited about the season. As you said, our first concert is in 2 weeks here. But as of today, today's the last day for this. We have an early bird special on season tickets, so you can get all five concerts for $36 a concert if you go to HonoluluChamberMusicSeries.org and purchase that today.
So once you purchase that, you see the The Orvis Auditorium has enough intimacy, too, for people of this.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a 400-seat auditorium, but I like to say there's not a bad seat in the house. Everybody can always see the stage, and the sound will certainly fill the auditorium, so you never worry about not feeling connected with those performers.
I think the wonderful thing about this sort of music, evoking the emotions, it also can seem to take people, hey, I can make the world a better place just because of the emotion, the positivity of it. Sure, I mean, some people say, well, there's negativity, but just the overall thrust of the music seems to be, it's going to be better.
Yeah, and I think in some ways it's music, especially the music we get to hear, is the best of what we have to offer. We have all these true geniuses that have channeled their best music into chamber music, and we get to experience that live, which I think is quite a special experience.
I love that one scene in the movie Amadeus where they're doing ballet with the orchestra, and the king looks over and goes, "Is this modern?" When the other jealous guys rip the things up. But yeah, it's always modern if it's always good. That's the wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And the
yeah.
fact that you appreciate the timeless makes me know that, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but it's going to be a great season. Jonathan, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, my pleasure.
Being as Jonathan Court, the president of the Honolulu Chamber Series, which opens the 2016-17 season in 2 weeks. That's Tuesday the 27th with Time for Three in Orvis Auditorium. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more information.
Here's one thing HPR sustaining members know. Their monthly gifts mean a steady, predictable income for the station. And they also know we couldn't survive without them. Sustainers are a big part of the reason HPR can provide two program streams all day, every day. So please make your pledge of $10 a month to keep your public radio station strong and become an HPR sustainer. Call us at 955-8821 to set up your monthly support, or you can do it online at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. Once they were ubiquitous, and while pay phones have disappeared across the nation, in Hawaii there are plenty of them. With a look at why Hawaii still has more pay phones than any other state, Civil Beat editor and general manager Patty Epler has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
You know, every time I walk past one of those boxes with, you know, the pretty orchids on one side and the yellow phone, I think, oh, that's so nice, but what's it doing here? Why do we have all these payphones in paradise?
I still have the urge, like when I was in college, to stick my finger in the box and see if there's any spare change left in it. I'm sorry to say. It would seem to be, anecdotally at least, that the reason we have all these payphones here is because we're such a popular tourist destination, especially for visitors from overseas. And they just can't use their cell phones here, so payphones really help them out.
That would seem to suggest that in many other destination locations that we would also find many phone boxes too, or, you know, payphones. Is that true in other places, you know, California, Florida, whatever, that we might find lots of these things?
No, they're really going out of fashion on the mainland rather quickly. Hawaii had, I think, twice as many per capita cell phones as the next closest state, which was New York. And our decline in the number of payphones also has been much slower. We dropped from about 5,300 payphones in 2006 to 3,800 in 2015. So, you know, that's not really that huge of a drop. But in the U.S. mainland, in that same time period, they dropped from 1 million payphones to 153,000, according to the Federal Communications Commission. So really quite a dramatic decline.
And, you know, for people who travel across the country and see that, that's obviously apparent. And the reason, because we all usually have cell phones that can just go with us. And now that plans have changed, it's not such a big deal to take your phone with you wherever you go. But that seems to also be a little strange for Hawaii when you say that, you know, we have people here whose cell phones don't work. Why is it so unique in Hawaii that these cell phones may not work and we got to have all these phone boxes?
So, you know, no one has actually studied this. We just sort of stumbled across this doing another story. And so the best we could come up with was this idea that Hawaii is just always a little bit slower than the rest of the mainland to, you know, pick up on trends. Hawaiian Telcom is the company that owns most, if not all, of the payphones in Hawaii. They also have a pretty solid landline business. So in terms of economics for their business, it's pretty cost effective for them to maintain the lines and that kind of thing. Whereas on the mainland, you have to have various companies that are all sort of competing and trying to get maintenance and installation and that kind of thing, that kind of business. So maybe it's also the monopolies that we see here in Hawaii at work again.
Which is to say that we're going to have those pretty curiosities with us for perhaps a good long time. Thanks, Patty.
I hope so. I kind of like them.
So you can put your finger in there and check the change.
I could buy you coffee.
Okay. I don't know where, but, well, it might help anyway. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Patty Epler is editor and general manager of Civil Beat and editor-in-chief of HuffPost Hawaii.
Support for The Conversation comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting My Poina, The Overthrow, a dramatic retelling of the last 4 days of the Hawaiian monarchy, this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. in the McCoy Studio Theater, mauiarts.org.
And in the news, we've also seen this. Hillary Clinton stumbles both verbally and physically. The polls showing the presidential race tightening, another sort of ceasefire in Syria, and North Korea detonates its biggest bomb yet. Those are just some of the stories also on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan. He joins us most Tuesdays from his Macnut farm on the Big Island, but this week from Los Angeles. More on that later. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you. Now, on Sunday, we saw Hillary Clinton in some distress as she left that 9/11 remembrance ceremony a little early and stumbling on the way to her car. What was initially described as overheating turned out to be pneumonia. Do we have any idea of how this is going to affect a race already closer than it has been?
Well, you know, it's unhelpful in a number of different ways. First, she was, you know, just sort of getting up and running after taking most of August off to rest up for the stretch run, and even a couple of days away leaves the field open for Donald Trump. Now, he didn't help himself with some wild comments on the Federal Reserve on CNBC this morning, but the opportunity for him is still there. Second, that characteristic secrecy about the diagnosis does not help a candidate allegedly trying to be transparent. But the real unknown is whether voters or a significant number of voters is going to see an illness as weakness. Now, obviously, anybody can get pneumonia, but some people might see this as reason to raise questions about her toughness, her stamina, particularly after Trump and his surrogates were raising questions about her health. So, you know, what sounded like a conspiracy theory last week sounds a little more reasonable today.
A lot of women will recognize the fact that, you know, when you have to work regardless. But, you know, then again, we saw that verbal stumble from last Friday at a fundraiser where Secretary Clinton described half of Donald Trump's voters as bigoted and racist, you know, that basket of deplorables remark.
Yeah, and Donald Trump has jumped on this to say she's running a campaign based on hatred and race. Which seems a little rich from somebody who said so many racist and hateful things. But she created the opening, and even more damaging, I think, is his charge that it shows contempt for entire groups of people, you know, sort of inherent elitism of her seeming to look down on the great unwashed, and the fact that when she said it, it was meant to be private, So again, reinforcing that characteristic, Clinton's secrecy.
Now, wasn't it, though, about 4 years ago at a fundraiser that then-Republican candidate Mitt Romney was also taped about his comment concerning the 47%? Am I remembering that right?
You are. That's right. And 4 years before that, Barack Obama was recorded at a fundraiser talking about, you know, McCain voters who cling to guns and religion. And I think politicians would learn that in the age of the smartphone, absolutely nothing goes unrecorded. There is no expectation that anything will stay private. And you know, to be fair, I think Barack Obama learned. And as president, he allows the media into every single one of his fundraisers as a matter of policy.
Now, the polls are showing that the race was tightening before all of this happened. Now we're down to less than 2 months before Election Day, 2 weeks before the first debate. How's all this playing out?
Yeah, well, it's that familiar pattern. You know, it seemed like it was endless, and suddenly the campaign is running out of time. Now, those polls show Clinton's lead that was once around 9 or 10 points down to 3 or 4. There's a Washington Post poll out this morning that shows her up 5. We'll take that as a baseline. We're not going to know the effect of her stumbles, but I don't think they're going to help.
So doesn't this kind of raise the stakes for the debate even higher?
For everyone concerned. Now, the moderators have to be very worried about after the criticism that Matt Lauer received after his very uneven performance in the town hall event on national security. Do you try to fact check on the fly? And how do you do that when Donald Trump not only lies and distorts the truth so often, but then refuses to admit that he does?
Okay, but now he's saying that there shouldn't even be moderators, that the debate should just be the two candidates.
Well, that's not going to happen. This is just to set himself up as a victim. He says the moderators will treat him unfairly, and you'll remember how he treated Megyn Kelly of Fox News when she asked him a tough question on women during the one of the debates in the primaries. This is just so he can avoid questions by turning it around and attacking the moderators. But one more point on this. A couple of weeks ago when Clinton was busy building what seemed like an insurmountable lead, we talked about, you know, the inevitable next story, which would be the Trump comeback. Well, now we've seen it. And I guarantee you the next story after Clinton's bad week will be her comeback. And we've got, I think, a few more loops left on this roller coaster before it's over.
Okay, for the moment we're going to leave that, but I want to talk to you about some international news. Now, last week, President Obama and Putin left their meeting in China without agreement on a ceasefire in Syria. Then the foreign ministers worked out a deal, took effect yesterday. Is there reason to be really optimistic that this agreement will be more effective than the one that sort of unraveled earlier this year that we talked about?
Well, you know, you have to hope so, but there is such a divergence of interest here and so many players with agendas of their own. Now, Russia, of course, wants to prop up President Assad, or at least, at the very least, maintain his regime in some form of power. Now, this is a government very much dominated by one religious sect, the Alawites. It's a minority group that's ruled Syria for decades as a police state. And after 5 years of brutal civil war, it's impossible to believe that the majority Sunnis are going to let themselves be forced back into, you know, a submissive role there. But the Sunnis, of course, are fractured into dozens, literally dozens of different groups, including ISIS. Then there are the outside players, including Iran and Saudi Arabia, which see Syria as another theater in their larger Shia-Sunni war. And it's not just Sunnis and Shia. There are the Kurds and the Druze and other ethnic and religious groups. Turkey and Israel have interests of their own. Both of them intervened militarily just in the past few weeks. So how do the U.S. and Russia begin to get all of those factions on the same page when their interests do not coincide? We can hope that the ceasefire will hold long enough to get humanitarian supplies to besieged communities, at least to some of them. But a real peace process just seems unrealistic at this point, I'm afraid.
Now, while we're talking about some intractable problems, I want to ask you about North Korea, which concluded its fifth nuclear test, the biggest one yet. And it came on the heels of another round of missile tests. So do we go back to the United Nations for yet another round of sanctions? Where do we take this part?
Yeah, well, it does go back to the UN, but I think everybody sees that as an empty gesture at this point. The strategy of ever-tightening sanctions, you know, that worked to get Iran to the negotiating table, but it's clearly failed with North Korea. On paper, the package of sanctions that were imposed last March are plenty tough enough if China is willing to enforce them. And just as obviously, China continues to believe that as dangerous as a nuclear-armed North Korea might be, is better than the alternative.
Now, China seems to be worrying that cutting off the North Korean economy might cause the country to collapse. That would force them to deal with a flood of refugees and bring U.S. troops right up to its border. I mean, not a great scenario for them either.
No, but presumably Washington and Beijing could come to an understanding on that last point where U.S. troops would stay, you know, south of the 38th parallel, which is the current border. But yes, it would cause millions of refugees and an American ally displacing the state that was saved by Chinese blood 60 years ago in the Korean War. Those are all unacceptable outcomes from China's point of view. As we've talked about, China is very unhappy with its North Korean ally, but not unhappy enough to apply the enormous pressure that would be required to change North Korea's behavior.
Okay, so if the strategy of ever-tightening sanctions has failed, what's the alternative?
That's a good question. Sanctions came after the previous policy of concessions failed. North Korea used its nuclear program as a bargaining chip, you remember, agreed to shut it down and let in U.N. inspectors, but it did not last. And that was with the previous Kim. Young Kim Jong-un maintains he will never give up nuclear weapons. Now, some believe he might be willing to freeze development as part of a new agreement, but others believe he's not going to stop until he has a usable arsenal of nuclear-tipped missiles able to reach the U.S. mainland. And that, of course, is unacceptable to the United States.
That sounds rather ominous.
Well, you know, we're a long way away from military measures, or at least anything beyond the flyby of B-1 bombers we saw over South Korea this week. It's going to be up to the next president, either to open talks somehow or impose unilateral sanctions, third-party banking rules, cut off any institutions that does business with North Korea. That was used against Iran. It worked, but virtually all of those institutions in this case are Chinese, and it would infuriate the Chinese.
Well, time is our master, so we're going to have to leave it there for the moment. But I mentioned at the start of our conversation that you're in L.A. today at the start of a trip to Zimbabwe in southern Africa, which means that Neil will be out of touch for the next couple of weeks. But he's left us in very good hands. Starting Tuesday, September 27th, we'll be talking with Ken Rudin, Neil's old partner on the Political Junkies segment on Talk of the Nation. So, hey, have a great trip. And you'll be back to us when?
Late October. I can't miss the fun drive.
Oh, you wouldn't want to miss that, I know. Okay. Aloha, and we'll see you then in about 5 weeks. Enjoy the trip.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays, usually from the farm. While he's away, his Pacific News Minutes will be on hiatus, but like Neil, they will also return. And now, from the worldwide view of Neil Conan, we're now bringing it back home to our own backyard. In today's quiz, we ask you to tell us the Hawaiian name and location of the island's real-life King's Landing. It was made famous before Kamehameha unified the islands. While running through a forest after raiding a coastal fishing village, Kamehameha was surprised by two of the residents. Now, being large and intimidating, Kamehameha frightened the men, who hit him on the head with a large paddle. The impact split the paddle and left Kamehameha unconscious but alive. After being left for dead, though, the future king eventually came to and escaped home. It's said that this incident at Papa'i, south of the present-day Hilo, will greatly influence Kamehameha's attitude toward the common people during his rule.
And we have a winner, Kathy Kempa, who figured that out. She's from Barbers Point, also known as Kalaeloa. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Lila Goldstein is executive director of the Hawaii Women's Fund, and she shared an amazing story with me about how they're supporting female inmates who are preserving historical sites on Oahu.
One of my favorites was for women inmates to work on culturally significant sites here on Oahu around Kauai Nui Marsh. The day I went, we were at a site that's off of Kapa'a Quarry Road, And the leader took us around and he told us about this particular palm. There's only four in the area. It came from Lanai. And look at this boulder here. Do you see how there's this shallow, scooped out area? Well, that's no accident. That was on purpose so the Hawaiians could learn about astronomy. Because when it rained, that filled with water. And instead of craning your neck to look up, you could look in the water and see the reflection of the stars. He gave us the historic context of the area. He told us about the plants, which were invasive and non-invasive. And then we and the 10 inmates who were there started clearing out the invasive species.
Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
If you've ever looked at an intricate, delicately beautiful glass figurine in an art gallery or looked at vases and goblets which seem impossible to have been made by hand and wondered, how do they do that? You're not alone. And you have artisans including Mark Matsuda to thank. He's a master glassblower and teacher of the craft at Punahou, and he joins us in studio. Aloha, Mark, and how do you do that?
Lots of practice.
Like Carnegie Hall for glassblowers.
Pretty much. You know, they say that it takes 10,000 hours. And, you know, there's also a saying in glassblowing that that sort of technique is cheap in the glass world. But, you know, technique is really, really expensive, and it takes a massive amount of time to go and accrue all of that time. And, you know, to get to that point, it takes a lot of work and effort. And, you know, when you see someone and they can go and execute something flawlessly, it's usually because they spent a lot of time at their craft.
So you've had just probably, what, 9,999 hours, and you're just about there?
Yeah, I'm just about there. And you know, always kind of working on it, too. You know, it always seems like there's always something to work on. And, you know, that I think that's what also keeps artists going is that, you know, in the end, there's always something that you can always be working on.
So the adage, practice, 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 never goes out of style for your craft.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's also, you know, the love of the material kind of keeps you going. You know, even though you're spending all of this time doing it, you know, sort of that passion for the material is one of those things that really is a motivator to keep you in the studio and keep you at that work.
That material we're talking about, I guess start with the basics. That material is two elements, oxygen and silicon, combined as silicon dioxide.
Yeah, correct. And a lot of people, that's the material that if you're talking about glass, they talk about that as being sand. So that's the chemical that they're really referring to when they're talking about it. You know, regular sand is, you know, an agglomeration of a lot of different materials. So, you know, the sand that we have at our beach, you know, if we were to go and try to make glass out of it, wouldn't actually make a really great glass. But, you know, that silicon dioxide is really the primary ingredient of glass. And there's a bunch of other chemicals that glassmakers go and add to silicon dioxide to go and help to make the material go and behave in certain ways.
You got to get really hot with pure silicon dioxide, don't you?
Yeah, silicon dioxide doesn't melt until about 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, a temperature that, you know, you only find, you know, if you were to find, you know, naturally made glass, you'd find it in lightning strikes in the desert, or you'd find it in a volcano with obsidian glass. And, you know, that's sort of where the first glassmakers found glass. And we're able to access it. But, you know, human beings are really kind of crafty creatures. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're able to go and sort of find this material and recognize the properties of it and begin to go and kind of create it ourselves, which I find amazing.
So if we go back to ancient Mark history, here you are in the you discover glass blowing as every person, everything is new when they see it for the first time. You were a kid and you saw somebody doing it and said, I want to do that?
You know, I can't remember exactly where I first saw glass blowing, but when I entered Punahou school in the seventh grade, this was like maybe my first sort of recollection of it. I remember somebody telling me that, you know, oh, one of the things that you can do here at Punahou is you can go and blow glass. And I remember, like, kind of vividly that conversation happening and thinking to myself, oh, yeah, that's something I would kind of really like to try out.
So when you tried out for the first time, you start making essentially a glass bowl or a blob and just go for it?
Well, you know,
That's right. You got students, so what do you teach them first?
Yeah, you know, the first thing that we teach everyone and is ingrained into sort of the way that we teach glassblowing is safety. So, you know, the first thing that you kind of make is you just kind of take these little gathers out of the furnace, like these just little blobs of glass on the end of tools, and you have to learn the skill of handling a material without touching it.
So, this stuff is hot. Even if you add stuff to make it cooler than 3,000, but it's still pretty hot.
Yeah, it's still at 2,200 degrees Fahrenheit.
Only 2,200.
So, you know, it's like, you know, I don't know, like 5 times hotter than baking cookies. So, you know, so there's that skill. But, you know, when you're making glass and when you're working with glass, there's kind of two kinds of students I see. I see the students that kind of, when they approach the furnace, they either step forward or they step back.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first started blowing glass, you know, it was like galvanizing. It was like somebody sent an electric shock through me. And like all of a sudden, everything at that point kind of changed a little bit.
So it's like music. It's a transformative, inspirational act.
You know, I think with a lot of sort of things in the arts, you know, they are these galvanizing experiences that happen, and they change you in ways that you hadn't expected.
So you have students that come in either moving forward or moving back, but almost whenever the semester's over, they come out with that certain gleam in their spirit.
You know, I always do, and, you know, there are some really unexpected things that happen. You know, even some of the students that take that first step back, and I've got students that I'm absolutely convinced are having the worst time of their entire lives when I'm watching them. And they're the students that come up to me and surprise me, and they come up to me and say, you know, this was probably the best class I've ever taken, and I had the most fun ever in this class.
I have a feeling it's going to go on like that. Glass, wow. Mark Matsuda teaches the art of glass blowing, and he learned it there at Bonneho, where he now teaches. Mark, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Continued success in blowing it.
Thank you very much.
His work is in numerous private collections, as well as the Hawaii State Foundation for Culture and the Arts. He's featured on PBS this Saturday, the 17th at 8 p.m. on the series Craft in America. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for details.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting Spyro Gyra in 2 shows nightly, on stage tonight through September 18th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
The spark of the creative inspiration, be it glass, be it music, I've always loved the way people who get into it just think they can make the world a better place because they are part of the world they're making it. The teachers that inspire us are these incredible motivators.
They also teach us how to sort of change our emotional states, and that's part of it too. You know, when you're, as you said, having a bad day, maybe the worst day ever, and whether you go off to a dance class or to blow glass, there's that sense of being transported, and maybe that's a skill we all need to learn a little bit better.
You hear a beautiful song, and then you're feeling kind of blah, and all of a sudden there's a little tiny glass hedgehog that's about an inch across. Whoa! And your whole day becomes brighter.
Speaking of the glass hedgehog that's now on my desk, thank you very much for that one. And that's going to do it for us on this Tuesday morning. Now, tomorrow we'll be talking with Paul Brubaker about a new economic report on the state of the seed industry.
And we'll be speaking with musical legend Sergio Mendez as he continues his Hawaii concert tour.
Meanwhile, if you'd like to be in touch with us, there are lots of ways for you to do that. The best one is probably calling our talk back line, because we love to hear your comments in your own voice. Please be sure and leave us your name and your city or town. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. Or if you like email, we've got that too. It's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of the show or want a pass one, find them on the Conversation page with links for more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Sage.
And I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning with more of the Conversation.